Welcome back, everybody, to another Sack Manager. This is episode 135. I'm John.
And I'm John.
Happy Easter, everybody. It's the Wednesday before, I guess, Good Friday and so forth. So to all listeners, happy Easter. And if you are celebrating, obviously.
Well, you're Greek and you're celebrating next week.
It's early Easter. Correct. I was just going to ask you, when is the Greek Easter? That's next weekend.
Next week. So I've got two Easters to get through.
Cool. So it's been probably three or so weeks. And to be quite honest, you know, like I'm actually glad that a few of those weeks where we didn't do anything, because it was just we've had a really roller coaster sort of ride over the last couple of, over the last sort of month. There's been some, definitely the last 2 weeks with the Newcastle win, the 5-1, and obviously the Aston Villa win last Saturday. And can I just say, how great was it to actually play on a Saturday? I'm just sick and tired of the especially over here, like the Monday mornings. It's just it just doing my head in. And I think that's part of the issue, is that to watch it live, literally at 3:30 in the morning or whatever it was, just before the daylight savings sort of kicked in. Before the daylight savings sort of stopped, literally a fortnight ago. It'll take us like 2 or 3 days just to get around to actually even watching the match. I mean, because you sort of get up even at 7, and there's no time to watch it, and you're sort of watching all the different YouTube channels talking about it and so forth.
And but we're back in the office too as well. So
correct. So all the travel time, and you're back home, grumpy as all hell, and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's the truth.
But anyhow, let's talk about the here and now. So after, as I said, some pretty ordinary sort of results, maybe 4 or 5 sort of weeks ago, we definitely seem to have, this particular week, it was sort of like one of those very, very rare occasions where everything went right. So it started off with the Man United lost. We know that Arsenal lost.
Yeah, even better.
Yep. We know that West Ham lost, I think, against Leicester a couple of days ago, or yesterday, or whatever it was.
Yeah.
And someone else lost. Who else?
I don't know. I think they're the only ones that
So those sort of three or four sort of rivals that are sort of hovering around in that sort of thing of four. All it took was us to go to Aston Villa. And
from history, our history of doing that, where, that hope of, all we need to do is win, that doesn't mean anything, does it?
Correct. But after the 5-1 win against Newcastle, and, I was sort of beginning to think, maybe we are sort of turning the corner. I mean, for Christ's sake, even Doherty is playing well, was playing well till he got sort of hacked down. But and we'll get to that. I don't know how you want to dissect this particular game, because again, it's a game of two halves. In the end, we definitely, that second half was just an amazing thing to watch. But, even though I found it kind of stressful watching the first half, I was praying for halftime, because the two halves were very different. Yes, we got that sort of first goal, but after that, Villa just piled on this unrelenting amount of pressure. I mean, I couldn't believe how unrelenting it was, and I think I said to you that. Now that I know the result, I can sort of go back, and I think I might, maybe on Good Friday or something, where I might sort of go back and I might watch that whole game from back to front. And I very rarely do that once I've watched it. I might watch, the 15-minute sort of little highlights thing that Optus does for us. But But yeah, this is one that I think I might actually enjoy watching, you know, like even though you know that we get pummeled, but you know, I thought Lloris, for me, and I know we've said it before that, you know, he's got us out of jail, he's got so many credits, you know, that from here to the day he retires, he could have a bad game and he'd still end up on top. I actually thought that this was, I think possibly, it's by no means a flawless game because he made one crucial blue in the second half that almost led to a goal. By then, I think Villa were broken anyhow. But in that first half, you know, like, it could very well have been 5-1.
I mean,
you can say what you will about, you know, Ings missing and Nash missing some goals and, you know, a couple of them. You know, what was the name of the? Let me just check the lineups. Ramsey, sorry, and even that McGinn, you know, was kind of, you know, really sort of he took a couple of shots that just fizzed like either side of the post or over the crossbar, but you know, like, but there were a hell of a lot that Lloris had to make some pretty amazing saves, you know. There was the one, I think, that where Ramsey had that the corner, and it was going in, and he had to really readjust himself, you know, because it kind of like dipped, and it was like the wind took it, and it was going straight in, and he was at sixes and sevens, kept it out. There was the flying one-hander where he went to his right and saved it with his left. I mean, when I first saw it, I thought, oh, that's regulation height. When you watch it in replay, you can see that he was scrambling and that, you know, it was like, you know, the Mark Schwarzer hand of God, you know, from 2006 for the World Cup qualifiers. Anyhow, getting off the point. How do you want to chat about this? You want to split it into two halves or...?
Well, there were two different approaches, and I think in the first half, you were right. Not only were they relentless, there was that bit where Ramsey went through three of our defenders.
The Doherty like they stuff. Went there. Yeah, just on Doherty. I mean, when you watched it, it you know, from the camera angle, it just looked like a standard foul. And when you think about a standard foul and you think about, you know, the players rolling around, when they did the real close-up of it, and I'm really surprised that whoever was the main doing it was a BT Sport or BBC or whoever does it, you know, we get it obviously through Optus, but they actually went through and you saw basically like it was right near the line and that player, I'm pretty sure it was Ramsey or McGinn, I can't remember, I'll say it's Ramsey, but I might be wrong, send me corrected. Just went right through him, you know, like almost like the whole body. It wasn't a kick or anything like that, but you know, like it's like the knee was sort of up, and it wasn't like you kneed him or anything like that, but you just got the inside of the thigh and the force going up against Doherty's body. I mean, especially when you don't think that is the challenge that's going to, you know, break you or snap you in half. I mean, when you looked at it, I thought that was akin to like a like a car crash. It really was. I thought, you know, like when you watch it, like, and you see it from that angle where he is like literally the contact takes him off the ground and actually up in the air. Like for a human to do that, like you have to be like, I know like Gerard, for rightly or wrongly, set out the team to really, give it to us to be as physical as all hell and to throw us off our game sort of that way. And I think probably under Mourinho that we would have given way. But I think that, you know, you got to say a lot about the resolve, about the defence and so forth. But that particular challenge, you know, there was a couple, they had to go at Son as well. They had to go at Kane as well and a few others. You'll probably go through them, I know. But yeah, that was just, you know, that particular challenge on Doherty. I mean, he's out now for the rest of the season. I don't really know how I feel about that. But definitely, like it's the best that he's played for us, and it's almost like he's won that sort of battle, and you know, with Reguilón, almost where Reguilón is kind of like the reserve now.
And he's on the wrong wing as well. Wing.
That's the other thing is that, you know, you got Emerson Royal. He's almost like got the two that personally I would have got rid of, a couple of months ago. And three or four weeks ago, people having a crack at both of those players. You know, was it the Leicester game where, where they thought Doherty, you know, sort of, had it sort of like a comeback, you know, a resurrection of self, so to speak, you know. And then a couple of other sort of like kind of looser sort of games. But, you know, I think where he's against players that he feels like comfortable with, you know, like players like, you know, representing, let's say, like Newcastle and Villa, you know, yeah, that's kind of his level. He can have the ability to excel. But that challenge, I thought, was utterly shocking. And the other thing, before we go any further, that referee Jeff Scott, he's the modern day Uriah Rennie. And I don't know if you remember Uriah Rennie from it's either the late 90s going into early 2000s. He was one of those ones that. He would have some utterly shocking, and then he'd be in the championship for 4 weeks, and then he'd come back to the Premier League. Like he was always one of those sorts of referees, but he made some he was shocking for us. Whenever we have him, there's a shiver up and down my spine because we just don't know how he's going to be. He often lets the game kind of referee itself, I think, especially in regards to players and their challenges. That Doherty challenge didn't even get a yellow card. And then the yellow card that he started, you know, brandishing was like way into the second half when really everything was pretty much like, I think only Danny Ings sort of got it. So, let's go back to you originally. Yeah, I think I've said my thoughts on some of those challenges and so forth. I mean, I think maybe Ings got one maybe in the first half, but I think the Ashley Young one was kind of cynical. But yeah, I thought Jeff Scott again as a referee, not his proudest moment as doing that.
Well, there was a lot to look back in that first half, and I think that foul was such a disgrace. And it's not like, oh, look, he recovered. He had to come off, you know, and you were right. It was almost like a car crash. It's kind of like the speed he was going across down the wing versus the guy running at him at sort of the opposite angle. You know, you've got nowhere to go. You're going to go out and flying because of this force that hit you. And he wasn't even, you know, the cynical aspect of that, he wasn't even going for the ball. Yeah. You know, he was going for the guy. And you could sort of, that cynicism that this side has, you know, it just sort of almost evaporates all the good stuff that maybe they have done, you know. So, beyond that, if you looked at that first half, the thing is with Spurs and with this defense as well, is that if someone has a go at us, if someone really puts the pressure or attacks us in numbers, we do struggle. And that Ramsey kid, like where, you know, there was one moment where he dribbled past three of our defenders like they weren't there. And there's other attempts where they were playing the ball and they're having shots. We were lucky, A, that some of their finishing wasn't good, but also Lloris decided on this day to really pull his finger out and have a performance and a half. And that was very true. And he did save us. And I think the rest of the team recognized that as well. You know, I mean, I know Sun got awarded man of the match, but Lloris, like sort of in the past, kept us in the game. You know, yeah. These incredible saves. You know, things that, and I suppose as the years have gone past, as recently, has become a little bit more erratic. There've been times where he can't even protect his sort of near post, but the stuff that he performed in that first half was incredible, and I think that was acknowledged. And the my disappointment was that with that pressure on our defense, they couldn't really step up and take command of that, because really Villa, if you look at them, they're really a mid-table side. Okay, let's be honest. Okay, they've got a couple of promising kids, a few veterans, but overall, really, they are where they are because, you know, there's no, oh, you know, they're having a bad run. This is where they need, they're going to be. So if we're basically, if you put a bit of pressure and on Spurs defense, we know this is just going to happen, you know, but they, because of their relentlessness and because they sort of, they were just driving and driving in the first half, I suppose their plan was a bit blitzkrieg, hit them hard and also score, you know, and basically get into halftime being two or three goals up, and then Spurs, you know, you've done Spurs over. That Lloris plate performed so well, but it is still an issue. And my looking at that defense is like, they need a lot more work still, and we probably need to recruit one or two defenders we need to play more as a unit. I still see them as almost individuals doing their bit, but not an overall group. And also the support that they should be getting from in front of them from the four players should be stronger. They're the ones that almost like are that line in front of defense who should be trying to aiming to stop some of this stuff coming through. But I suppose the other thing is that perhaps Villa gave it all in that first half and they were just spent after that. You know, they're not a side who would be able to do that for 90 minutes. I mean, if they could do that for 90 minutes, they would have walloped us. But I think their plan was, let's hit them hard first half. Let's see, go in front and then just hold on for dear life. Mm. But yeah, look, there were concerns again where we are, our back line is not our strongest point in this team. but look, overall, we did what we needed to do and we got out of there leading 1-0 at halftime. You know, you can't really, you know, everyone, if some of the defenders didn't step up, Lloris did. And that's really why he's a World Cup winner, because when sometimes he needs to step up, he does.
So that's a very interesting point. So so the three at the back were Ben Davis, Eric Dier, and Christian Romero.
Yeah.
So would you say that Lloris's saves were more out of any particular mistakes or something that you didn't like as far as the defensive side of things? Were there anybody, because for me, I was sort of thinking when I was watching, I was thinking, well, you know, like we can't pass out of the half, but we seem to be absorbing and taking the hits and the pressure. And no doubt, you know, obviously Lloris saved us. We've already sort of sung his praises a little bit. I guess where I'm going with this particular question is, do you think that there was any particular type of play or formation or players that you thought had a particularly, you know, even though we didn't concede, that had a particularly bad first half that sort of led to the shots that Lloris had to save and so forth? I mean, did, you know, for example, like, you know, it was a clean sheet for us, but, you know, you may have thought maybe Højbjerg, didn't sort of play well, or maybe that you thought that Eric Dier could have done better, you know, to sort of present? Was there something like that that didn't quite rest well with you?
Yeah. I don't know, really. It's just...
And that may not be the case.
But you in the past have said football is a game of moments.
Yes, I have.
You know what I mean? Yes, you have, which I keep remembering. And so it's when that moment comes that do you step up to meet that challenge? You know what I mean? It's, yeah. Okay, most of the time it's with us, you know, it level we can cope. And the way the team's playing defensively for the majority of the game, they can cope. But it's those moments when the opposition step up to another level. And then, for instance, that Ramsey where he dribbled past three players, how do we respond? You know, that's when, how do we step up to stop that challenge? And really, a lot of that, and some of the other attacks, we didn't. You know, we didn't step up. They bamboozled us in a way. So how do we approach those moments next time? What do we, you know, if they learn from that, and if they say, okay, through their tactical work, you know, when a player comes through this way or that way, you know, one player needs to be doing this, another player needs to be doing that, and practice that tactically, it's kind of like sometimes, you know, past coaches, and I don't know if Conte was one of them, would go through how tactically to play a game by walking it, doing it in slow motion. So, and it, in a way, I know, you know, reading about it, where some players would think it's a joke when I could run, you know, but it's like, no, that's almost like building the memory of where you need to be when this situation happens. So if we learn from that, I mean, and really, look, that sort of dribble by Ramsey.
Yeah.
It's sort of one of those special moments in football where you sort of, I didn't, but when you enjoy it, it's kind of like off the cuff thing. It's not something that perhaps, and maybe I'm being unfair, like you can tactically prepare for, but then you almost need sort of zones of protection as that happens. So you might go through one or two, but then other players step up and stop it. But I don't think they did. Didn't he have a shot? I can't remember. You know, it's all. I watched it. I should have watched it again. But
I think that particular point there where he got around three of us, I think he did have a shot and it deflected off somebody. I can't remember.
Yeah. So yeah. So in a way, we were fortunate with some of their finishing wasn't ideal. And in a way, maybe I'm being a bit unfair. Maybe some of that finishing was due to where Spurs were tactically, like sort of the players were. I didn't really sort of observe it too much. I mean, because I watched the 25 minute thing, and I'm really more concerned, to tell you the truth, at the moment, because we've had issues with our defense for quite a few seasons now. I just want to sit there and really look at how we approach the counter-attack. Pardon me, because we've had three managers now who play a counter-attack game. And to me, I like seeing how we approach that. What do we do? What are the variations of the counter-attack? Is it a long ball? Is it four passes to get to a certain point? Like, for instance, in this game was Harry Kane's vision, almost as a midfielder.
Yeah.
You know, presenting other players, you know, with chances. So, I mean, I'm kind of enjoying that aspect of the game because, A, we're getting better at it and we're scoring quite a lot of goals. But also it's kind of like, to me, it's like, okay, how are we developing, evolving that approach from the attacking point of view? Because really, I think we, like the game showed us, we still have issues from a defensive point of view. You know, we're not, I don't know what it is. It could be personnel. maybe they're not playing as a unit. Who knows? But look, like you said, I mean, there were certain moments, but those certain moments were special for Villa. And then we couldn't counter. It was kind of like Lloris. And he's part of, you know what? It's kind of like, well, it's his job? He's supposed to save the ball. So, you know, but some of those saves were spectacular. So overall, for me, it's like at the moment, with only a few more games to go, I'm enjoying and observing that aspect and how we evolving the counter-attack. Because after what, 5 seasons of almost Pochettino all-out attack, where our basically playing on the front foot was how we stopped other teams playing. We played better. We played with more intensity. We took the, you know, we took the forward step to attack, which led to other, you know, other teams backing off, being on the defensive. So there was that approach. And I think for me, I mean, I really should stop talking about it, but that's how Spurs, I hate the word DNA, but I think that's how Spurs as a team became who we are as part of our, I'm not going to say DNA, but I've said it anyway, but you know, since the push and run era of the, you know, 50-51 with Rowe, and sort of developing from there, and then having Nicholson, who actually came through that team as a player, and developing that even further and having the success in the 60s and continuing with that attacking style. And then in the 80s, where we had a side, you know, when you've got someone with Glenn Hoddle, you know, of course you're going to be attacking, but continuing that, it's sort of like a natural evolution or progression of that philosophy. This is how we play. It's kind of like, as well, it's like Man United. They got that out of the 60s too, and so that's their natural way of doing things. So when you get someone, and we've had, you know, the last managers where that approach is different, then I'm enjoying the aspects of, as they develop, that counter-attack, that attacking aspect of the tactics. It's like, okay, here we are. Where are these attacking players once we get possession of the ball? And how do we take the 2 or 3 steps for us to have a go at goal? Sorry, I was a bit meandering. And I keep on mentioning Pochettino. I think we'll be doing this. If we were doing this podcast in 15 years' time, you'd be like, you know, when Pochettino was managing, oh, not again, stop it.
Okay. I don't disagree with anything you said. I think you've spoken a lot of sense. But
you're the only one who said that.
Make sure you get that on repeat or something like that. Yeah. But yeah. And obviously at halftime, it was like, okay, wow. Let's see what Conte can do. What will he change? How will the players respond? You know, because that's one of the things. It's like the mental side of things, I think, has always been a bit suspect. Although the one thing I will say is that, and I don't know if it's just because of the last two games and the results and the way that we've played, In both games, like the Newcastle game and this game, we never started really well. I know in this one we scored the goal, but when you think of the first half, we didn't really start well. But it's always been the second half that, you know, we've sort of done it, and you know, he sort of changed some things around, and the same thing happened again. And I don't know quite why that is the case. You know, maybe are we set up to be a little bit of trepidation maybe in the first half, or we'll just wait for that, you know, only go forward for that one particular time. I don't know. Anyhow, I'm talking a lot of rubbish, but it was definitely a transformative second half. You know, we started with, obviously 1-0 became 2-0, Kulusevski, the Swede, on the 50th minute, and then 2 further goals by Son on the 66th and then almost like the, now the sucker punch in the 71st. And like literally, I think by the 71st minute, Villa Park was three quarters empty. you know, and I think that, you know, like with a lot of the fans, they would have taken a lot out of that first half and go, you know what, we quite possibly could have been 5-1 up or 2-1 up or 3-1 up, you know, whatever, you know, Lloris has a good day, you know, yeah, we've got Spurs. And then to be sucker punched with, you know, not only two right jabs, but a left as well. Those three extra goals all of a sudden just killed them. And I think that, you know, if it wasn't Kulusevski's goals, it was certainly Son's second goal in the 66th minute that completely killed. And you could tell the Villa players just said, this just isn't working out, you know?
Yeah, I think the intensity of their play in the first half wasn't rewarded, but I suppose they would have felt confident if we can do this in the second half, we'll get something out of it. It's always hard when you're really sort of really pushing and exerting yourself and you don't have any reward. But I suppose Gerard would have said something to him and encouraged them. But the same from our end, I think you could tell the good coaches is when there is an issue and, you know, they go into halftime and they come back and it's changed. So whatever he said to them, whatever changes he made, the team changed. But also I think the sharpness of the finishing. You know, you've got three players now, okay, that can finish and finish well overall. It was Suns today. And then I suppose as well, one thing we have to add is Kane's game.
Yes.
In that his assists, his vision. I think that it's been highlighted. There's one bit where the ball, long ball to him, he just a quick glance to his right to see where Son was, and he just had it, headed it over the defender who was right behind him and into an open space. And Son, he understands Son's game. He understands his speed. He probably also understands where he prefers to have the ball. And in a split second, that was all laid out for Son for that goal. And away we went. I think the sharpness of the finishing is good. And I suppose before that, when Conte started playing this formation, my concern was that there was a lot of players like outside of those, even before Kuzi came, where they were getting into attacking positions, and we're talking, you know, about our Spanish lad, Hoybier, a few others, you know, Hoybier. Where they were getting Hoy and Hoybier, and they would just mess up the finishing. It was that last bit where, okay, you've got it into that spot. You've done very well tactically. You know, there's no one going to stop you, and the ball just goes flying somewhere. And that was my concern, was like, it's okay if we're going to play this formation and the counterattack, but if the players who are about to shoot can't shoot or have not been, you know, haven't done that work in training, what's the point? What's the point of, and I suppose the difference now as well, and then unfortunately he's injured now, that we had that extra player on that left who could finish and shoot and also get play the whole point of this counterattack where the right wing back and the left wing back almost become that extra attacker. So they come from behind.
Yeah.
And Doherty was actually taking that step up the last few weeks. He was really up there. There was a game against Newcastle where Son got in just before him, but he was heading into the same spot. And Son got in before him and shot and scored. But Doherty's idea and the way he was set up and the way he ran, he was heading to that spot. So if Son wasn't there, he would have had a go and he might have scored. But to me, I'm enjoying that approach by those guys, you know, because they're the ones that will stretch the defense. If the defense saying, well, there's this guy coming from the behind them, that should stretch them. You know, that's like, oh, there's another person we've got to worry about. But if they're thinking, mate, these guys never score, who cares? No one would track them because they, yeah. But I think what we've seen in the last few games is really the attacking approach of this system working quite well, where we've got those players that can do the job within this system. And the sharpness, I think, in the last few weeks of finishing is incredible too, where they're almost hit their perfect time to hit their peak. You know, yeah, with 2 months to go, they're just really the sharp. You know, they don't need 15 shots at goal to score. They need 6 shots to score 5 goals, or, you know what I mean? It wasn't, they don't have that many, they don't require that many chances to finish off a game because of the sharpness. But also, I think with this game, the talent of Harry Kane, how set up a couple of those goals was perfect. He realizes and he recognizes other players' games. So he sort of sets it up that way.
How did you like his header to that?
It
was sublime.
Really clever. Yeah, clever. Just like you sort of see it in slow-mo where he looks to see where Son is. It's like, yep. And he only needed a glance. It's like that. And because the ball's coming towards him, that's in the air. It's not like the ball hasn't come to him. He has a look. The ball's up in the air from, I think, was it Romero, straight at him. And he glanced as the ball was coming towards him. So he already had set himself up to get that ball. And he still has the confidence and the skill to have a glance, you know. And it's half a second, but then he's confident enough to know where the ball's going to be, you know, because with these modern balls, they go here, there, and everywhere.
Yeah.
But he was set up to go, okay, I know this. The ball's coming towards me. Let me have a look. I don't have to adjust myself because I'm standing in the right position for that header, that glancing header, bang. You know, it's just those little aspects of his game where, you know, if it wasn't for his finishing, he could have been a great number 10 midfielder.
Correct.
Yeah. Correct. So I think some of this stuff is good to watch. And it's, you know, like the last two games, he's scored a lot of goals, but really he hasn't scored that many. But he has provided enough for us to win those games. So he's a very key player for us. And I hope he's there next season.
And speaking of next season, I wanted to just talk about the two recruits and what they have brought to the team. So Bentancur and Kulusevski, Cooley, as you say. So Bentancur we have secured. So he is our player.
That's good, yeah.
Kulusevski is our option. So he's on a year and a half loan. You would be, and I think it was like maybe 25 million or 28 million. Which for me is sort of like a steal. But, you know, with both of those guys, you can just see, you know, like why they were at Juventus, you know. They are shining lights and have, for me, laid their footprint, their stamp on this particular team. And you could probably even say that those two players have played an instrumental role, even though it's a team. And that some players, you know, I think that what they have brought to us definitely has contributed and helped to kickstart and brought other players into the play, especially Kulusevski. But you know, I particularly have been impressed by Bentancur.
Yes,
there was one part where I think he went boot to boot with. I don't know, McGinn or somebody else, you know, I can't remember who it was. And he went down, but straight back up again. You know, there was no like rolling around or anything like that. You know, I mean, this guy is tough and he's a baller.
He's from Uruguay. We know about them as Australians.
Exactly. And when you think about Kulusevski, I mean, we've always sort of wondered, you know, like, how should we set up? Should we just have Kane up front, you know, Do we have, you know, do we have guys like Lucas and Son just behind, or, you know, do you have like a front three? And, you know, the big problem was never so much about Son, you know, like, you know, leave him out on the left, but it was all about, okay, you know, to make something work, you've got to sort of change him to maybe play a little bit more centrally, or do you sort of then say, okay, well, Lucas is just going to be, you know, just the person that's just going to provide the run. And it you know, there were times where it worked, but never a full game where you'd say, yeah, that was sensational. You know, certainly not since, you know, the Champions League against Ajax like many, many years ago. But now that we've got Kulusevski playing in that position, I mean, just the different dynamic, his coolness on the ball, his finishing, his eye for a pass, he's looking up and knows where the ball is and where he wants to do, especially for that third goal. He is getting behind the last defender and cutting the ball back, I think, magnificently, not for the first time as well, but obviously that sort of best describes that sort of that last goal that made it 4-0 that Son sort of scored, that obviously gave him the hat-trick. Just your thoughts on both of those players. I personally, I would be staggered if we didn't just, you know, just in case something happens with Juventus and they start saying, oh, you know, guys, you know, we need to redo this deal or something like that, you know, because I guess, you know, being on loan, you know, is there, you know, with this particular, is there always that sort of possibility that you could be brought back from your loan or something? Or maybe it's the agreement that's in place where it can't happen. You know, with that in mind, I would be very surprised if Levy at the end of this season just doesn't stump up the 28 million and say, there you go.
Well, I hope he does. I'm surprised he hasn't done it yet. I'm surprised he said, well, look, I think he's going to wait to the end of the season, because then, you know, due to an injury or something like that. Because if he gets injured, you think, oh, do I pay for another season of him sitting on the bench?
Correct.
But I think Juventus is one of those clubs where when they buy players, they know exactly what they're getting, because they'll fit within the traditions of winning at that club. You know, the one thing you might say, okay, the Italian league might not be, this is going to be controversial, might not be at that standard of the Premier League, just say, but at Juve, you have a club that has been a traditional winner of trophies. There's that expectation that those players have to meet that standard and surpass it. And if you don't, well, you're out the door. So I think with us, and these guys aren't old. These guys are very young still. Aren't they like 22 like 20, or 20?
Yeah. Like Kulusevski, what is it, 21 or 20 even?
So they've improved the side tremendously at such a young age. And I suppose Juve have let them go because they're probably saying, oh, well, they might become, you know, great players.
But we can't see it happening. We can't see it happening now. They're not going to displace the current side.
Whoever. Exactly. So it's our opportunity, and they're lost in a way because you don't know how they're going to mature. It'd be interesting to see what happens next season, but I think both of them, I think for a start, Cooley is just more consistent than Moura, all right, full stop. I mean, Moura will play a fantastic game. Think, oh, he has to be in every week. And next week, he doesn't play a great game.
Correct.
Our issues with him is like his lack of consistency at a certain standard. He'll play one great game and then might not play great games the next two, so then he's on the bench, someone else comes on, and then, you know what I mean? It's, he hasn't made that position his. Then Cooley's come in, and his consistency in high standard during the game, now he basically deserves that position.
Absolutely.
Because 100%. Of what he's done. Yeah. And he's also much younger. So it's kind of like if a younger player is doing much better than you and, you know, Lucas has got that extra experience, then you're going to play him. You know, he's going to miss out. And the thing with Benteke as well, being in the middle, he is not just a defensive midfielder. He's more closer to a proper midfielder. So he's got an eye. His passing I really enjoy. But he's also prepared to be tough and be like do the defensive aspects of his role, really get in and really get hard. But then he can turn and he can read the game very well. And then some of his passing within the last few games have been great for us, like from an attacking point of view. So for us, he's a really good asset because he's got two aspects of his game where his standards are high. On a defensive angle and in the attacking aspect of our how we play. So the thing with getting these players is that they were very well bought because they understand Conte's game very well. And that's the key now to whoever comes during the summer. You know, in the past, do you remember with Bale's millions where we just bought players? Wasn't
the Magnificent Seven.
Yeah, there wasn't a reason why he got bought. You know, these players. I mean, for Eriksen, we needed a playmaker, fine. But with some of the others, it's kind of like, okay, does this person fill a role in this team? Do we need that aspect and his skills? Will that improve us? And that would interlock with the rest of the players. We just bought players. It just felt like, okay, he's available. We can buy him because you can buy him. I don't know what the reasoning was for some of these. You know, it's like, is he fitting into a slot? Is he replacing someone? It's kind of like when, you buy play. It's kind of like, you know, the joke is the Man United, where they've just been buying millions, you know, spending billions of dollars on players just for the sake of their name, as opposed to are they going to fit in your side? And I think with these two players, they fit perfectly in the way Conte plays. And that's why our team has been enhanced by their skills, because they slot into the play. It's not like we didn't get someone to go, oh, he's pretty good midfield, I'll put him in, as opposed to, but is he going to add to the style? Is he going to, you know, do that role that he's sitting in there for? So they do that. And if that means buying more Juve players because they understand the way that that's played, let's buy more. Yeah. I don't care if this is what we're going to get. And before Conte came, we've bought a few players. Patrici bought some players that maybe have not fitted in. But hopefully with Conte there, and Conte's got his scouts, he's got his people that he knows that will come back to him and say, well, this guy's good, or have a, you know. So it's not going to be a one-way conversation with Conte saying yes or no. Conte, I think, realizes who he wants. He's got a whole lot of contacts in Italy, especially. And then with the other kind of research that the football department will do, you know, they'll probably come to an agreement and to fit in, because we need to take that next step up. We're pretty good so far in how we play, but this is almost the prologue of what this team might be capable of under Conte. He's slowly building, putting the pieces together, and we definitely need probably another four or five, maybe even just to strengthen the squad, you know. And he's still got two or three kids coming through. The only thing about, for me recently, is that he puts more up on, as opposed to I would put Bergwijn on.
Yes, because I agree.
Because of his speed, he can really bedazzle some of the defenses. And I think his shooting's better, even though he has scored many. I think his finishing's better than Moura. And maybe it could be because of a positional thing where Moura almost sort of plays from the right and Bergwijn maybe on the left. I would give him that opportunity to move there. It's like, okay, if you want to stay here, because really when he plays for Holland, he performs because he starts, you know, he's one of the guys, if he does move, he's very unlucky because the potential has always been there from an attacking point of view that he could really perform and shine for us. And unfortunately at the moment, he's got players that like with Son and Kane and now Cooley, who are just on fire, you know, but I would give him more chance to play or come on before Moura. Because we've seen Moura, we've had him a few years, we know what he's like, but I don't think we've seen the full potential of Bergwijn. What can he do? Even when Kane, like in this game, Kane was playing deeper. All right, if Son, you know, if Son sort of gets injured, and we hope not, Bergwijn's the natural choice, I suppose, because of his speed. And if Kane plays that sort of deeper attacking role, then he's going to lay everything out for him on a plate. Well, anyway.
Is there a spot or a formation that you see where Bergwijn does start?
And not about
injuries or anything like that. Is there somewhere else? I'm looking, you know, at the, you know, we played a 3-4-3 on the weekend.
Yeah.
And I don't think he's a winger. I think that that's been the problem, is that we've forced him tried to force him in somewhere and they've go, okay, let's try him in the left wing. I don't think that's right. I think that he is either Son or Kulusevski, isn't he, you know?
He has to play that high up. I think under – and the thing is with him, he's tried to adapt to whatever the manager said. I think with Mourinho, he played him in defensive – as a defensive player, defensive position.
And it's kind of like – that sent him back, I think, a season or two. Absolutely.
Because we didn't buy him for that. We didn't buy him to, you know, for that. It's just basically Mourinho goes, oh, maybe I can transform you. No. Surely you know your players. He's got speed. And not only that, I think his confidence dropped as well. I think he said, what the hell is he making me do? You know, I am wasted here. And when he did get a chance to score, he wasn't scoring. I think it was just he was thinking too much. I have to score. You know, just thinking too much on the ball. I need to score this to show them that I can finish. And, of course, it didn't. So in a side like this, and especially when you're 3-4 up and he comes on, just give him, like, just go and play your game, fit it within the system. And if you miss, we don't care. We know you'll score. You know, and give him that confidence where if you're a player and you come on like that, give him the confidence to say, you play your game. You do what you need to do best to score. If you don't score, it doesn't matter. You'll be back next week, you know. And that gives that confidence to that player. So each time he misses, he's not thinking about the good strikers when they miss. They don't care because they go, oh, I'll get another opportunity. I'll score because I'm that good.
Yeah.
You know, and I think he's got that potential to be really, really good for us. I mean, you never know. It might be that we don't have Kane next season and he sort of slots in, but
I don't have that same feeling. I sort of feel as if why would he go to Man United? I think the City thing is done. I don't think they'll come back.
You think?
I don't think that they'll come back. Well, unless they're prepared. I mean, he's probably playing better now than what he was last year. And Levy was after, what, 150 million? He has every right to ask that. You know, it's not like, you know, like I know last year we were sort of saying, well, you start off with 150. I mean, what is he going to be, 29 next year or whatever? You know,
I think he's almost 30, isn't he?
Well, correct. Yeah, so he could be 30 next year. And you start to think, well, okay. He hasn't shown signs of any sort of weakness. If anything, he's actually getting better. he might be like Ronaldo. He could play till he's 38. You could definitely see a scenario where, I mean, clearly he looks after himself. You know, I mean, yes, there's the knock on
him. That's the key, though.
That's the key.
He looks after himself.
The knock is, you know, that, yeah, well, you know, he's had a couple of ankle injuries, and, you know, and that might take a year off his career or whatever, you know. But even at 36 or something, I mean, there is still 5 or 6, you know, sort of years there, you know.
I
definitely think that the next 4 could be at the highest level, you know, where like I said, where other players have started to show signs of awareness, of the body just
even set a 23-24-year-olds in Newcastle.
But I actually sort of think that 100% that he, you know, I don't see any other club willing to pay that amount of money. They will come out and say, well, he's not Ronaldo. But I said, well, to us he is.
Yes, to us he is.
You know what I mean? Like he's that sort of influential. I mean, he's the current captain of England, leads the line for them. You know, he's got Conte. I sort of felt there was a time where I wasn't sure that Conte would still be there at the end of this season. Whilst there is always that sort of thing sort of going on, because you don't know what's happening in other clubs wanting to poach him, because everyone would That's be marveling true. At how he has transformed the club. I mean, imagine if we had him for the full season, like the whole preseason and so forth. The big key is going to be how do we lock him down? And just going back to Kane just very quickly. You know, again, you know, I'll say it again. I don't think that City would be paying anywhere near that sort of money, regardless of whether they've got the money or not. I don't see him being remotely interested in going to any other club. If you take City off the table, you know, I don't see Liverpool being in love with him. You know, there hasn't been that connection. It's really being, I guess, Manchester United, and they are as close to a rabble as they've ever been.
Look,
even in the, you know, who was the guy before Van Gaal? The one where Alex Ferguson said you got to give him a go.
Moyes,
yeah. I mean, that killed David Moyes' career. It's only really what he's doing at West Ham now that has him remotely relevant. I mean, he went to was it Racing Santander or
something like that? Yeah,
or Rayo Vallecano. So yeah, or was it Real Sociedad? Yeah, one of those sort of clubs. You know, that didn't work out well.
Well, the issue with Man United has been Ferguson, because he's still there. His influence, even though he really doesn't really have the power, is enormous there, because, you know,
absolutely
what they should have done and sort of agreeing with him to bring in Moyes, it was ridiculous. It's like, why don't you just go for the best manager there is? You've got the money to buy them. You've got the money to support them with the players that they need. I think it's because they didn't really have people there like the Glazers who understood how things worked at Man United. They got there, and even with the team that Ferguson had, and you know what, it wasn't one of his fantastic teams, he could still squeeze performances out of them and win the league, you know. So once he went and some of that magic was gone, sort of the reality of some of these players sort of came to light. And then they just bought players like Di Maria. They bought Di Maria, great player, but he disappeared. And then a number of players like that, you know, sort of happened at Man United. And I think the problem is at the moment with that side, and I think probably Harry Kane's seeing it, is that they're disjointed, they're a rabble, like you said, and they're not a team. And that is because of their players who are so self-centered that you know, you don't have the manager, you know, the manager's appeasing them, as opposed to Ferguson when he thought he had enough of some of these players, like Beckham left, Stam left because he wrote a book or something. He got rid of them.
Yeah.
And you need Stam. Someone, Yeah. But, you know, didn't he write the book and you know, and it wasn't approved by the club and they said, okay, you can go now. I can't remember what it was. But for them, if Harry's probably looking at this and going, these guys, they just don't know what they're doing. They're so self-centered and no one, you know, they're getting paid so much money and it's almost like there's no responsibility. They keep on losing or they're drawing and they're still in the team. They've got a guy who's, you know, dead man walking. He's not going to be there at the end at next season.
Yep.
Now they're talking about, you know, who they need someone who's going to go in there as a manager and remove the players who are not, you know, playing to his tune. And who cares how much they cost? Who cares how much their shirts are bringing into the club? You need to remove them. You know, like Ferguson did, he got rid of the players that he thought they were bigger than the team. And he has to do that. Whoever's coming in, he has to do that. Anyway, that's not even our issue. But
yeah,
Harry would, unless someone comes in and does that, why would Harry go there? And I'm sure he's one of the best paid players. I mean, it might be money, but is that enough? Are Man United going to win you trophies like you've been talking about? I don't think so.
No.
You know, they could be right.
Yeah.
You know, I suppose it also depends who comes in during the summer, who Conte recruits, and how they will improve the side. If I think with Conte needs a constant communication with Harry, say, I want you to stay, you're an important player, you lift this club, and I'm bringing in these players too. And this is how they will help us improve the side. And top four, you know, just finishing top four is not going to be enough for us. You're a winner. I'm a winner. This is what we're going to do. And bring him along, you know, sort of really tell the story. Tell you the truth, I'm a little different to you. I think Man City has seemed like, you know, where they were at a time where they were how many points in front of Liverpool, and then they just kept on dropping points. And that always happens with Pep's sides because – well, they only sort of are limited because they don't really have an out-and-out striker. They can't play a plan B or whatever. And to tell you the truth, the way Harry plays now for us where he will drop deep and so forth, I'll tell you the truth, it looks like he's someone that would fit into Man City very well because of those tactics.
Oh, and he absolutely, absolutely he could. I think that the issue is going to be, we're in a different spot. I mean, we're coming out of the Mourinho era, going into, you know, the, what was his name, Portuguese guy? I forget the coach. Oh. I've conveniently forgotten. But anyhow,
I think both of us.
Nuno's minute, I think, his tenure was called. Nuno's minute, but you know, like you know. The time really, it was quite logical for Kane, you know, like you want to continue, the club is going nowhere. You know, things were looking incredibly bleak, you know, recruiting nobody, all that sort of thing. Of course, things have changed. Conte, possibly the world's best coach and mentor, manager, you know, you see his infection on the sideline. Why wouldn't you want to play with him? Champions League, I feel as if it's like on the cusp. I really feel it's on the cusp. Now, don't get me wrong. We've got to go to Liverpool and we are hosting us. It's not like we're going to Arsenal.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we will beat them. We'll beat them comfortably. I mean, let's just very quickly. Hang on. Just to close that off, I think that Kane, I don't think anybody besmirched like his want to leave to better himself. But I think that the club has turned itself around with almost single-handedly with Conte, and definitely those two players have been a statement for him to say, yeah, this is worth hanging around, you know. We are actually going somewhere, you know. I mean, that's the way that I feel right now. Now, there are people who are going to say, well, how did you feel 3 or 4 weeks ago? Fair point.
The thing with it, though, in contrast to that, how would it feel like being managed and mentored by Pep? That's the interesting thing. You know how intense, I mean, look, Conte and Pep are intense managers. Pep has a different style, and he wins lots of trophies. Okay. And he has won for Man City, and you know, they're there, you know, they're very close to, you know, winning the league title again. So to him, it's like, let's forget about the money, because Man City, whatever Kane's getting now, Man City will go, whatever you're making, we'll double it. We don't care. You know, and you can see that. But I don't think, if we think away from the money, it's like, fine, he's got Conte and all that, but then he's got Pep with a different style, different philosophy, different type of intensity. You know what I mean? It's like, that could be an attraction to him. That could be, well, you know, Pep's one stuff, but because I think Kane's a thinking footballer too. I hope, anyway. It looks like he is. So in his mind, he could be saying, I wonder how he approaches the game being in one of his sides, going through that process week in, week out, what he tells you, his ideas, blah, 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 blah. You know what I'm – it just seems like he's the only one, I think, who Kane could be attracted to because of who he is as a manager. I can't see many others, you know, like Klopp and that. I can't see him going, I want to, you know. But Pep and that Barcelona side that he managed, you know, the tiki-taka.
Yeah.
That's it. That's my only concern, is that because if Pep doesn't win the Champions League and he goes, then that's a different ball game. Well, I can't see anyone at that level. You know, they might buy the best manager, but who's better than Pep, or who is around that you could say, oh, that guy's pretty good?
Well, I think that right now Kane would be sort of thinking, you know what? The club has done everything in its power, I think, right now. I mean, personally, I think we could have had a better transfer window. We need to see what happens in the summer. I think that this summer is crucial. Now, I think one of the good things is that the World Cup is not in the summer. It is later in the year.
Yes,
towards Christmas time. So we don't have that prohibition, for lack of a better term, where, you know, we have to wait almost till the World Cup's over, you know, for all the managers and so forth to be blowing, you know, astronomical transfer fees at us, you know.
Yeah.
This is going to be a very, I know we say this all the time, but this, when you think about that, this is a very critical window for us, extremely critical. And I think that, you know, one of the things that I just, you know, we're playing well and that's great, but I still think that we can't go into next season with these same players. There needs to be more change. And that's regardless of the pats on the back that we're giving, you know, guys like Doherty and so forth. You know, you have to think, is he the sort of guy that's going to take us to Champions League for season 23-24 or 22-23, whatever next season is, you know, and you have to sort of say, you know what, he Conte has got the best out of him, but just how long will that sort of go for? You could say the same thing about Moura. You could say the same thing about Ben Davis. And you could, you know, for those, you know, like me who are critical, who think critical, great YouTube channel. I think that that you've still got to put a blowtorch under Eric Dyer, and you need to make a decision. You know, is there better out there? I think there is. But this is the thing: is that there are fans, like, you know, on the YouTube channels and so forth, they're saying, oh, you transformed it around. You know, it's almost like we've forgotten what happened two or three sort of months ago, where, you know, there were defensive flaws all over the shop. I think right now, if, you know, once again, this is one of those Spurs miracles. If we can get into the Champions League with some of these sorts of players, but we cannot. And this is the thing that I hate about Levy, is that he will go back and say, these players got us there. We need to reward them. The players would love that, but I don't think that that is best practice. So Paratici still has some work to do. And if there was one thing that I just enjoy about having Conte around, apart from what we've already talked about, is the fact that he is one of these managers, I think, that has the big kahunas to stand up to Levy and say, if you're not going to get me the players that I want to progress and actually do something meaningful next year, not just contend, but be a really, you know, take it to the next step, because these players aren't going to do it, don't get me wrong, he'll walk. There is still that there. And that's why I think that this is such a critical summer. And I, you know, you can't tell me right now that Paratici and stuff isn't planning.
Oh, yeah.
All of this sort of stuff. So, and I just think that without the, you know, if we had the World Cup, we'd be waiting until the World Cup finishes. We'll be waiting 4 weeks after the players have their mandatory, you know, unionized breaks. And so forth. And I just think that just not having to deal with that is going to be, it has actually worked in our favour.
I think with Paratici having a good working relationship with Conte in the past, I think they will gang up on Levy and say, this is what we want. These are the players that we need to get. And if we need to spend extra, we will spend extra. And I think Levy, he's got himself in a bind that you can hire one of the top five managers in the world. However, if you don't support him, then that becomes obvious. Then that's up down to him. And we need someone to hold this team together and get them up there before Ange Postecoglou comes and then we start playing fantastic football and winning.
You know,
all the
I'm
trophies.
A fan. You know, I'm a fan.
I think he's going to be, I think, one more job and then he'll be at Spurs. One success after Celtic and maybe, you know, maybe a mid-table side in the Premier League and then at Spurs.
He would be, you know, like, I want Conte to stay and so forth, but if he were to go, like, at the end of next season, he would be perfect.
Yes.
He would be perfect for us. And I know maybe overseas listeners probably think, what has he done? What has he done? He's done a heck of a lot.
Considering where he's come from and
exactly
his philosophy. And you know what? He's never panicked about how he plays football. You know, there's always been the doomsayers and so forth. And really, you know, the political aspect of him resigning from the Australian team. And we sort of see the results now of what's happened, him leaving. But he always has a certain philosophy he pursues. And at Celtic, all these people who are expecting a European coach, European players, he has brought, you know, a fresh touch, fresh players from Japan as well and from Greece and all that. Sort of not the A-grade countries, but players who have got skill and tenacity. And they're playing probably the best football Celtic has seen since, I don't know, the Lisbon Lions back in the 60s. So
exactly.
You know, it's kind of like I know our background is Australia. We know what he's achieved. And the way he plays football, it's like, oh, I wouldn't mind that.
Exactly.
Can you imagine Conte spending all this money on great players? He goes and then we get Postecoglou to play with the toys. Yeah. Anyway, that's
The last thing I'll say just about the Levy thing, it comes down to what we've talked about and what other podcasters have talked about. It comes down to ambition. What does Levy want to do? Is he still the stubborn AF person, you know, that you know is still going to be, you know, looking and managing us from a spreadsheet? Or, you know, is he finally going to actually back the manager? Because that's been the thing where I think it's been clear that he hasn't backed previous managers.
Well, I think
he's never backed
well,
Pochettino.
But I know, and that's, we regret that. But, and you know what? And it's not as if Conte goes out and buys 150 million pound players.
No.
You know, he buys players that suit his system and fit in the gaps that he needs for that team. So these guys that we bought, they're not that much money. Like, you know, any player under 30 million quid these days is a bargain.
Absolutely.
Isn't it? That's the level that we're talking about where, you know, guys like Maguire cost 80 million pounds for Man
United. They can keep him. They can
and
keep
him. And that worked out really well. But
how he gets an England cap is beyond me. Sorry, I've never seen, you know, I just don't see it. But the English selectors do. Yeah.
But Paratici and Conte, their knowledge probably of European football and players, and especially players in Italy, is so good. And I think Paratici doing all these deals, he will get the players that will fit in this team, improve the side, which is what we want. We want our starting 11 that's better than this current side. And they will find players who are not going to cost 80 million pounds. You know, so they'll find players that will suit his system, who have that ambition as well, who have that tenacity. And if that means going to the top two or three Italian teams and going, yeah, I want him, they're not going to cost 50, they're going to cost 30. The price doesn't matter if they fit in that side. So I think hopefully Levy has the confidence in these two, you know, to take it to the next level. And okay, if you need to buy five players and they're all 40 million pounds each, spend it, 200 million, but you've got, you know, five players that would take you to the Champions League season every season, you know, because that's how good they are. I suppose we just have to wait till June and we'll see. Or July, I think. July 1st, I think, when the contracts all go,
Our next game is against, you know,
your mate,
my mate, Graham Potter. So, we're entertaining.
Can you explain to the listener why he's your mate? Come on, old mate Potter.
Look, I know people will say, "Well, how do you know this? How do you know?"
I said that.
Yeah, it's nothing to do with what Graham Potter has done, but the fact that, yeah, I think that he turned us down. Where he thought that Brighton had a better prospect. You know, was he right? Maybe he was right. Yeah, when you look at what was happening with Nuno at the same time, you know, I think one of the things was, you know, what was our ambition at the time? Was the ambition to go and was Graham Potter the person? Well, go out and get him. You know, just put us out of our misery at the time. I mean, we know how long the search sort of went for, but I actually think that Graham Potter knocked us back. I think that he, and I have a big problem with that.
You too, I know.
but the thing is, I've got, you know, deep down, I have a lot of respect for him and I think he's a really good manager, but there's just something there that I would like to beat Brighton and beat them quite convincingly.
Yes. I'm glad you explained it to the listener, because whenever you met, you could sort of tell by the inflection of your voice that you're not best mates with him whenever you that word Potter enters your mouth.
Yeah, it doesn't mean I don't respect him, but, yeah, I just, yeah, there's something there that's not quite right.
Yeah, and, but like I think I said in our conversations that that was just that was in the media, but you don't know whether it was just a story put out to add more misery to Tottenham. We know most of the media don't really appreciate us.
There's no doubt that Graham Potter has this season, whenever I've watched Brighton and he's been in there, you know, the way that, you know, the clothes he's wearing on the sidelines, you know, his laid back attitude, you know, he's got the hands in the pockets, you know, he's walking around. I mean, you know, there is no doubt in my mind that he this year has got tickets on himself, that he has, and I'm not saying that he can't do that, but he's got tickets on himself. And I think that he is definitely one of these guys that, you know, thinks that he's, you know, I think capable of a little bit more than just Brighton. But, and the fact that he didn't think that we were included in that, I think sort of pissed me off.
Well, that last bit, you need to put in parentheses, because you can't be 100% sure that he said no or he was asked.
I can't but even. I've never even heard that language before. So whatever you said, that P word, whatever it is,
parentheses, you know,
whatever that means.
Yeah. Well, look, I think it's great that you hate him because of something that he might have said.
sometimes you just have to act on a feeling, and for me, I just have always just had this bad feeling. But remember, like he turned us over last year, like maybe once or twice.
Yeah, yeah.
You
yeah,
know, yeah. So yeah, so maybe he thought, like, why the F would I bother coming down here? It's like, I get it, I totally get it. But you know, when push came to shove, like, who was the bigger club? Brighton and Hove Albion or Tottenham Hotspur, and he chose Brighton, and that was like,
and they don't even play Brighton, they play in Hove.
Yeah.
They can't even play in the bigger city.
Yeah, it's just like, just go away.
One day in the future, he'll put out an autobiography, and in it he would say, I was never approached by Tottenham. I don't know why the Spurs fans hate me. I was never approached. I would have loved to go to Tottenham. And it'd be dedicated to you.
Well, then I'll put out a public apology on friggin' Twitter or whatever, you know.
Whatever there is in 20 years' time.
Yeah, exactly. But anyhow, let's get into it. So we're playing, actually, this is kind of an inconvenient time for me. Saturday the 16th of April, so this Saturday at 9:30 p.m. our time. Well, so normally I would be lapping this up. But yes. Collingwood aren't playing. But I looks like I will have some tickets to the NBL, which is the basketball sort of league here. So and these are kind of, you know, in the fancy swancy sort of box and so forth.
Oh, very good.
So I can't give that up. But
did Chinny get your tickets?
Yeah. Well, they're not 100% confirmed, but it's kind of very close to it, you know.
Oh, is this like, I know a guy who knows a guy?
Basically. So I'll be putting a ban on you from texting me, because as soon as I get home, I'll be whacking it on. You don't even watch it live. So
I jinx them. So actually, you know, well, if you're going, but Collingwood aren't playing, are they? Oh, okay.
Collingwood are playing tomorrow night.
Tomorrow night, yeah.
It's Brisbane Lions, they get thumped.
I can't believe we've got Good Friday games. There's two of them.
That's been happening for years now.
I find that astonishing.
It's nothing new.
Yeah. Oh, well. You know, Carlton aren't playing then, so that's fine.
Yeah. There was a meme going around where it had like the dynasties of the AFL dynasties, right?
Yeah.
So they had Geelong, between 2007 to, I don't know, 2011.
Yeah.
They had Hawthorne from, I don't know, 2012 to 2017 or whatever. They had, yeah, Richmond from 2017 to, and then they had Carlton round one to round three.
You know, after round three, I messaged you saying, I bought my grand final tickets.
Yeah. Yeah, the lid was off. The lid was off, and you paid the price.
Yeah. I think this week we'll do better. We'll do much better. We'll win this week. And then, you know what, to tell you the truth, you know, I might be joking about grand finals and that, but I'm looking at it as 12 wins. If we can get to 12 as quickly as possible, that means guaranteed finals.
Yeah. All you need to do is finish in the top eight.
Yeah, that's all I want this season. That's all I want. And they've sort of won three. So they've done a quarter, which is not too bad.
Yeah.
You know, they're giving me that sort of dangerous hope that Spurs keep giving me, you know. I can't do it with both sides. It'll be like the that Star Wars film where, you know, the war's about to crush them. It'd be Spurs one wall, Carlton the other, and I'm in the middle being crushed because my hope is gone because both of them are killing me. I think we'll win.
Right. Yep. I think we'll win. I was going to say, 3-1. Do you want to give me you 3-1. not even waiting for me to ask you for a prediction. No. Normally you don't like giving these predictions.
No, it's going to be a tricky game. And I think, your mate Potter would have watched the last two games and sort of set up a system where he thinks he can win, but I doubt it. I think.
Well, I'm going to go for a 5-0 win.
Oh my God, you really hate him, don't you?
Just before we go, check your phone. Have you got your phone on?
I saw. I see where you got it from. You know, I really hate Dave Hughes.
Well, is he a Carlton? I'm guessing he's a Carlton man. So
I don't know. Is he?
I believe so. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go. Well, three games isn't too bad.
Yeah.
5-0, you said.
Yeah.
I'm glad we don't bet on this thing because.
I might put like a cheeky $20 on it or something. If I can work out how to do that. I've never placed a bet in my whole life, so.
Oh, okay. So it won't happen.
Actually, I have placed one bet, and that was the World Cup final against in 2006.
Yeah.
Where it was against France and I forget who the other.
Brazil.
Yeah.
No, not 2006.
Yeah.
I
think I went for a 0-0 at the end of regulation time.
Oh, okay.
It was 7-1. And I put $100 on, and I got $700 back. And I've never bet since.
Wow, that's a good career start and finish.
Yeah,
that's very good.
Yeah. All right.
So how come your predictions are always wrong when we give it at the end?
I don't know.
I'm going to call you the $700 man now.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm happy with that. All right. Let's All right. call it a day. And, and I think now that we're kind of back in the office and we kind of know a little bit more about what our days are kind of like, we can hopefully between now and the end of the season, sort of put out something a little bit more regularly than what we have in the last month or so.
Yeah, yeah, let's see how we go, though.
Yeah. All right. Come on, you Spurs.
Boys.